I am Carol, an alcoholic. And my sobriety date is April 17th, 1995. And Midtown in Washington, D.C. is my home group. And we also meet on Sunday nights as our home group meeting, but we have other meetings during the week that we meet at, and it's a great group. I think it's the best group in the world. And I hope you think your group is the best group in the world, too. I thought there'd be lots of announcements and, like, collecting money and a few other things before I had to speak. So I am kind of nervous because I've never spoken for the length of a meeting. We usually have two speakers during our meeting, so that's my experience. But and my biggest concern is that I might forget my life. You know, it's like I forget a lot of things these days, but I'm hoping that I'll remember parts of it. Anyway, the book asked me to speak about, you know, what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And a lot of different things did happen along the way, but, you know, this is my second time in AA. I got sober initially in 1981, and then I decided to stay sober on my own for a while, and I can assure you that doesn't work very well. But I'll start with, you know, my early life. So many people talk about it, and it's been true for me that when I was a kid, I never felt, you know, quite right, and I never felt, like, accepted by the people I wanted to be accepted by. And I guess it's because I always had a way. You know, my way was I wanted you to be my friend. I didn't really want you to be my friend. You know, it's like that. And so if you weren't being my friend, then there was something wrong. And you know, I can still create life's little tragedies that way if I think that way and have my own way. So I grew up in, you know, a small town in New Jersey. Actually, there's only about 300 people there, so I'm really actually pretty comfortable in this kind of area because we were surrounded by farms. Now it's actually a bedroom community off from New York, but at that time it was pretty small. The cows got loose in the middle of town one day, and we all had to go chasing them down and putting them back in the dairy farm. So, you know, we had those kinds of experiences. The weird thing about my town is that there were, I have four really good best friends, sort of, when I grew up, and all of us have alcoholic fathers in this very small town, and mine was one of them, and my father, you know, was, his father was an alcoholic. His father was the town drunk. He died in the streets of our town. In a small town, that's really something, you know, and I, you know, then my father was an alcoholic, and none of his brothers and sisters drank heavily, but he was the only one that I felt, you know, that really seemed to have problems. And, you know, and my gut told me that, you know, I was going to be an alcoholic. I just knew that. I sensed that. And I've learned since I've been in AA the second time that, you know, a lot of times my gut speaks pretty clearly. And I should have listened then. But basically, I grew up as an only child, and my mother was my third and fourth grade teacher, and she was the principal of our elementary school. So I had a few things that, you know, kind of was good and was bad, you know. you know, I got teased a lot because of it. And then I went on to high school. You know, my cousin was one of the well-known teachers in that school, you know. So it's like when you're in a small town, those things happen. But as an only child, I thought the world revolved around me, and I got really self-centered, and, you know, I tended to stay that way most of my life, and I still am, but hopefully AA has helped, you know, trim some of that a little bit so that I can, you know, learn to be more other-centered than so self-centered. And so what happened was I decided as a kid that, you know, I didn't want to be like my dad. You know, he had two businesses he drank away, and he, you know, he was rarely at home. I remember as a little kid I begged him to come home for Christmas Eve, and he just, you know, he couldn't do it. But I didn't know it was a couldn't. You know, I thought it was a wouldn't, you know. And I started, you know, at first I pat him on a pedestal, and I blame my mother for the way he was. But, you know, later on I came to really, I don't know if the word is hate, but I, you know, I really was so angry at him. And as a teenager, I just started getting mean towards my dad, you know, like, you know, when he asked me to do something, I just, you know, I was so angry. And, you know, that doesn't feel good today. And luckily I was able on the eighth step to do my amends to him. He's passed away, but I was able to do an amends. And, You know, and I'm grateful that I've learned through my own experience what alcoholics, what alcoholism is, and that, you know, he wasn't doing it on purpose. You know, he really couldn't do anything different. And so what I did was I decided I wasn't going to be like him, and I went through high school without drinking, which was amazing where I grew up, because we were pretty close to New York, and in those days you could drink at 18 in New York. So a lot of the people I knew, a lot of my friends, would go over to Staten Island and drink, and then, you know, but I didn't. I hung out with the, you know, the intellectuals and a few other people like that, and we just stayed at that kind of lifestyle, and so I managed to do really well in high school, and had a really, I mean, a lot of people hate their high school years. I kind of enjoyed my high school years, and it was pretty much a goody-goody. I did a few things that, you know, are pretty typical of an alcoholic, even when they're not drinking, but I got away with them, so that was cool. And I went to a really good college. I got accepted in an Ivy League college in New England, and so I thought life was just going to be wonderful. I mean, it seemed wonderful, in high school. I mean, I had my ups and downs with, you know, boyfriends or no boyfriends, or, you know, friendships or no friendships, and all that stuff that we go through when we're an adolescent. But it was pretty, you know, it looked like my life was going to be great. And I got to college, and it was the first time I was really away from home. I'd gone to some sleepaway camps, but not much. And so I felt really uncomfortable, and I immediately started feeling a depression, which I really hadn't had much of in the past, you know. I felt lonely. And even though there were a lot of other girls, I was in a co-ed school, but the girls had our own campus, and we did a lot of things together. And, you know, I started making some friends through our dorm life and everything. But I just felt different. I felt afraid. I felt alone. And, you know, I found out that these are feelings that, you know, I would have all my life. And some of the feelings that I drank over. And what happened was, I got a friend of mine that I met there, fixed me up on a blind date, and we went on this date. And even though my school was an Ivy League school, it was a real party school. All the boys' dorms had a bar in them, and all the fraternity houses had two bars in them. So, I mean, it was really encouraged. In my freshman year, they had, all through college, they had sherry hours. I was 17 years old when I went, and they were just handing me sherry to drink. And that was, that was another thing in itself. But this blind date, the guy was getting annoyed because I wasn't drinking. And he, was like, what's wrong with her? She's not much of a party girl, all this stuff. And he's telling my friend this. Said, you've really got to drink. She said, it's like, if you want to be accepted, you want to be part of, that's exactly, the thing that I was so afraid of, not being accepted and not being part of. So she said, I know how to drink. I'll go get something for you. And she had been a debutante someplace, and so she knew all about drinking, and she went and got me a Tom Collins, and she handed it to me, and I sipped it, and it tasted really good, actually. And I thought, well, gee, this isn't bad. And I drank some more of it, and I actually enjoyed it, and I thought, hey, what was I afraid of? This isn't so bad after all, And then I had another one. I had a second one. And, by then the party was over. Everybody was happy, like, okay, this is cool. Drinking's not a bad thing. I can do this. And so it seemed really like, this was maybe okay, and I wasn't going to have a problem. Well, by the end of that first month of drinking, I had my first blackout. I mean, I just was off to the races. I mean, we had a woman in the woman, like a dorm counselor she was, and she actually had flunked out of school and came back, so she shouldn't have been a dorm counselor, but she was. And she was 21, and she was able to get us whatever we wanted whenever we wanted it. And so I drank as much as I could whenever I could immediately. I wanted it so badly. And I didn't know how to drink, so I never had tried or no one had taught me. And so I just thought you drank until you were drunk, basically. I thought that's what you did. And when they had these sherry hours I was telling you about, at first it was great because it was free booze, but then you really had to talk to these professors that came. And so I realized that, if I drank too much, I couldn't talk to them. And I got so afraid that I finally stopped going to sherry hours because I wanted all that sherry. I didn't want to have a sip of sherry and talk to somebody. I wanted the sherry. And so I just stopped doing those. But, and so you know, that's what I did for the next 2 years. I drank as much as I could. I started failing classes. I didn't, you know, I had like a 1.75 my freshman year. And then my sophomore year, it went downhill because I ended up flunking out of college after 2 years. And, you know, and I, when I was home that's in those summers, you know, I learned to party with my friends and, you know, just was, you know, I was off to the races. And, but when I flunked out, you know, it was like, you know, wake up, there's something going on here. And it's really hard for me to remember exactly what I was thinking. You know, I knew I was depressed. Of course I was depressed. I was drinking all the time, you know, it's a depressant. But, you know, I didn't want to see that it had anything to do with the alcohol. I didn't want to see that. But I knew that there was a problem with the alcohol because I knew that I couldn't show up for things. Like, I couldn't show up for a calculus class in the morning at 8 o'clock. And I couldn't, you know, there were things that I couldn't do because of the alcohol. So I didn't think that it was like I had to stop, but I thought I had to control it if I was going to get anywhere in my life. And so for the next, I drank for 17 years. And for the next 15 years, I tried to control my drinking. And what happens when you try to control your drinking, it's not as much fun. But by this point, it wasn't a matter of so much fun. It was a matter of I really needed it. I needed it to live. And I get emotional when I think about how it affected me. You know, it's, anyway. So I spent a year out of school. I was sent to a psychiatrist. Because I wasn't supposed to flunk out of school, you know, like, and we never discussed alcohol. I mean, it was all about, oh, what was your father like? What was your mother like? What was your, you know, all that stuff. And I don't know how much it helped, but at least it got me back into my college, and I got back into my school, and you know, and they said I had to go to a psychiatrist when I went back. So I did that, and we never talked about, you know, alcohol particularly, but you know, I did try to control my drinking, and I did try to, you know, not get in as, you know, much to, I tried to show up for class and do my work, and I actually almost flunked out again my junior year, but I was able to pull it out. You know, I talked the guy into, you know, giving me a B instead of a D and stuff like that. So, you know, so I did finally graduate from that school. I certainly didn't do a great job, but I did graduate, and, you know, and I continued on with this problem with my drinking. And while I was in that school, I went off to, a lot of people want to hear this story, but it's like I couldn't relate it to my drinking. But it really is all about my alcoholism and the way I think. I have a twisted thinker up here. And you know, here I was in this school with all these really nice guys, and I could have, you know, dated a lot of different people that were pretty normal, you know, nice, normal guys. Well, I ended up dating people that were just strange. And the summer, you know, between my junior and senior year, I went off to do this missionary thing, or not a missionary thing, I was working with Peace Corps volunteers in Honduras. And I went off there to save the world. And you know, I have to say my drinking showed up there because I learned that they didn't have mixed drinks. So what I was drinking was gin and grape soda, which is really disgusting. But, you know, I had to have it. And while I was down there, I met this missionary priest who wanted to, you know, form a lay missionary group in Honduras. And so I got so real excited about it. And we were going to, you know, put this together at my school, get volunteers and everything, which we ended up doing. But he got sent up to the States for a while because of his health. And while he was up here, he ended up seducing me, and we ended up having an affair. And, you know, it was like, what was I doing with a missionary priest, you know, his Catholic priest, you know? And, you know, it was like, and it really actually affected my relationship with God because I was raised a Catholic. And you know, at one point I felt kind of guilty about it, and I went to the priest, and I, you know, tried to have confession, and he said, well, if you're going back, I was just going to go back to Honduras and do this missionary thing that we were going to do, and he said, if you go back there, then, you know, I can't give you absolution. I said, well, fine, and I walked out, and I never, didn't go back to church. You know, that was it. I was done, and, you know, I went back down there, and we didn't have our affair again. It was over, but, you know, that kind of person is like, what I was looking for. I was looking for, I guess, I don't know what, you know, adventure, something, anything, to not be real. I didn't want life to be that real, and, you know, and I drank through all this. And, you know, the person I dated after him was this Iranian naval officer who was working, at that time Iran was a friend, and that he was working with our Navy, and he got, the way we were broken up was the Navy put him in a mental hospital. You know, it was like that. And this is what I'm going through. So, you know, this is like maybe 2 years out of college, I finally ended up meeting my husband, who was the most normal person I had dated in, like, forever. And so I decided to marry him because he was normal, you know, it was like that. And it was, I don't know, that's just the kind of thinking that I have and the alcoholism that's in my mind. And so basically I went through maybe 4 or 5 years of trying to work jobs, and I kept a job for a year. You know, first I was a missionary, then I was a teacher, and then I worked for a housing program in Philadelphia, and then I was a director of a daycare center. These are the kinds of jobs I did, and I was in Camden, New Jersey. And all through those jobs I struggled, because when I was a teacher, a fifth grade teacher, you know, these kids would be so noisy in the morning. I had a hangover, you know. So I would give them tests to shut them up. And then, you know, at night when I should be grading their tests, I couldn't do it because I had to drink. And so, you know, they would be asking for their tests, and I just never gave them the grades, you know. And it was like that. And, you know, so I quit after a year so the people wouldn't find out that I wasn't doing half of the work I was supposed to be doing. I mean, I did some really good things, too, that I know that they appreciate. I was kind of creative, and I started a camping program for the fifth grade, and, you know, where they learned a lot of science. But, you know, I wasn't doing the basic work that I needed to do, and so I knew I had to quit. And then I went to this, when I was the director of the daycare center, I never wrote any grants, you know, to get money for the center. I just was, you know, doing my daytime job, but I couldn't do any of the after work stuff. And, you know, it was just my alcoholism. It was totally my alcoholism that was kicking my butt. But at that time, I had decided that I needed to do something else with my life, and I was also getting married, so I ended up going to D.C. That's when I moved to D.C., and I got married in August, and I started law school in September. And it, you know, it was quite a time, but, you know, I really was able to control my drinking then, because I had a goal, and it was pretty amazing that I could do it. I didn't get drunk as much. I was able to study during the day, and then I would get, you know, I'd start drinking as soon as I got home. And that's the way I lived for a long time. I would either be working or studying for, you know, during the day, and then I'd get, you know, get drunk most every night. And I was a daily drinker, there's no question about that. And my husband didn't know how much I drank for a long time because he worked at night. He was this saved me from getting into drugs, I believe, is that he was the family therapist and then director of a drug and alcohol treatment program for adolescents. So we didn't hang with people that did drugs. We drank a lot. You know, that's what we did. And that was my drug of choice anyway, so I was fine with that. And so we went, you know, we were married for like 4 years, and then we decided to have kids. And I believe that really brought me to my first bottom. Having children sounds strange, that'd be the cause of it. But as I said, I would work, go to school during the day, and then at night I would drink. But, you know, I didn't drink that much when I was pregnant. My body just rejected a lot of stuff, and I'm grateful for that because, I'm sure I could have damaged them greatly if I had been drinking the way I normally drank. But after I had twins, by the way, that's why I'm saying that. And after they were born, because they were twins, you know, my job said, why don't you take some time off and then come back part-time. And so I had a lot of time on my hands that I didn't have before. And almost immediately after they were born, I had to drink. I had to drink. And so I was drinking during the day now. I was drinking, you know, when I did go back to work part-time, I was working 2 days 1 week, 3 days the next. So I had lots of days off. And, you know, and I was drinking, and I started getting these wake-up calls, though, that, you know, about what was going on, really. And all through those years that I had been trying to control it, you know, as time went on, I was making more and more mistakes about my control, you know, and I would embarrass people at parties, or I would insist on driving and almost kill people in the car. You know, it's just crazy stuff that we all do when we're drinking heavily. But now things started really getting strange. You know, I was sitting there feeding my babies with the bottles, and the neighbor came by to say hello and see how they're doing. It was 11 o'clock in the morning, and I'm drinking an orange blossom, and I offer her one. She looks at me like I had three heads. You know, like, what are you doing? You're here alone with these two kids, and you're drinking, you know. And she didn't say that, but I saw it in her eyes. You know, like, no, thank you. Like, you know, like that. And it sort of got that little light going that we get sometimes, you know, where we start seeing ourselves a little bit, what's going on. And then the thing that really woke me up was one day I had my kids in they're under 2 years old, and I had them in a bathtub, you know, getting a bath, and I needed a drink. So I went to the kitchen to get a drink, and I forgot they were there. And I left them there for over a half hour. And, you know, they're always shoving each other and everything. Anything could have happened in that time when I wasn't paying attention. And that scared me. That really scared me. And I was driving I couldn't go to the grocery store without being really high. And I would drive drunk with them in the car to go to the grocery store. Left my groceries there a few times. I'd forget about them after I got them in the car seat. You know, just stuff like this. A friend called me and wanted help because she was having a miscarriage. I drove down to her house, and I drank before I left home, and then I stopped at a drive-in liquor store on the way and drank a whole bottle of wine before I got there. And then I was a disaster. I dropped stuff all over her house. My kids were under two, and they were running around unsupervised. If anything could have happened. It was just a scary, scary time. And I started waking up to what was going on, and I went to work, and I would sit in the law library and not be able to read or write, and that was my job, you know. It's like, I couldn't do it. I couldn't do my job anymore. And my husband was starting to wake up to what was going on, and he started threatening to leave with the kids. So all these things, and I just felt like, I felt terrible about myself, you know, that demoralization that we get to, that's where I was. And so I asked for help, and I asked, I found out about outpatient rehab, and I asked to go to that, and we had to work out a lot of babysitting issues, but I was able to do that. And so I'd go to work during the day and go to the rehab during the week at night, and they introduced me to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm so grateful for that, to found it, because, you know, where I grew up, it wasn't around there particularly. The only time I'd heard about it was one of my friend's father did go to Alcoholics Anonymous, and he ended up killing himself on the front lawn of their house. And so it didn't really make Alcoholics Anonymous seem that attractive to me. But they introduced me to it, and I started going to meetings. And I still wanted to drink. For 2.5 years I had the obsession to drink. And a big part of that was that I went to meetings. I went just before the meeting, and I left just after the meeting. I didn't get involved in too much fellowship at all. I had a sponsor. I always had a sponsor. But, you know, she was pretty new, too. And so between the two of us, I didn't do much step work at all. I didn't do anything, really, at first. And so Carol wasn't changing. I was the same person, just not drinking, sitting in rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and not really hearing anything. Because one of the things that happened when I came back here, and I started hearing, the only thing I could remember about what I had learned was turning it over. I didn't even know what that meant. But I remember hearing that. And that's, you know, after 6 years, that's pretty, pretty lame. So I was in meetings for 6 years. And thank God I didn't drink, though. I didn't drink during that time. And I was clean and sober for 6 years. And what happened was, a couple things happened. But my sponsor died in August. And my husband left in September, you know, and my kids were 8 years old, and I decided, you know, by that time the obsession had been gone for a number of years, and I decided I could stay sober on my own, because I couldn't deal with going to meetings with my kids. How was I going to get there? He wasn't around to take care of them anymore, and I was probably in very much self-pity, you know, I definitely was at that time, and just said, screw it. You know, that's the time when I needed to be in Alcoholics Anonymous, but I didn't see that, and I left, and I spent a lot of time trying to be the perfect mother, the suburban mother. And, I did the PTA thing. I did the swim team thing. I was a vice president of PTA and all this stuff. And, I still work part-time, and I did that all through there till they were 18, actually. And I just, tried to do all these things. And the whole time, I felt different. I felt like I really didn't belong with all these other mothers. They didn't really know who I was, and if they knew who I was, they wouldn't want to be around me. They wouldn't want me around them. They wouldn't want me around their kids. I had my kids do brownies and Girl Scouts. I have two girls, and I was the brownie cookie mom, and I was the camp out mom, and all this stuff. I tried to do that to feel better about myself, and it just wasn't working. And eventually, what happened was my brother-in-law is a psychiatrist, and he decided that I was really depressed, and he said to me, "Look, I take these pills; it'll save your marriage." He felt that if I wasn't depressed, that things that were troubling my husband and I would go away, and other things. And so I fought it for a while because my first sponsor said, "Watch out for that stuff; it's really dangerous." And I didn't listen. Here I am. Years later, 8 or 9 years later, and I have no one to talk to. I'm not an Alcoholics Anonymous anymore, and I have no one to talk to about it. So I finally said yes. And so I had, I had the antidepressants, and then I had uppers for ADD, which everybody in Alcoholics Anonymous has ADD, I'm sure. And he decided I had ADD, so I was taking that stuff, and that just really kicked my butt. So here I was taking these pills on prescription, but I'm a real alcoholic, and what happens is I go by my feelings, and so on days when I was feeling good, I would stop taking them because I could remember my first sponsor saying don't take those, but then I'd start feeling really bad, and then I'd start taking them, and I'd take more than I was supposed to, so I started abusing these pills, and that's really what happened. But I had no intention of ever going back to Alcoholics Anonymous. I figured it, it did what it did, and that's it. I'm done. And I'm not drinking. But I really was. I was drinking freeze-dried alcohol is what I was drinking. But I didn't see that. I didn't know that, But what happened was the second time is my kids by this time were 14, 15 years old, and they started having trouble with drugs and alcohol. And there it was, family line, we're just doing well here. And it got so bad that one of my kids got kicked out of high school, and she attempted suicide, and it was just a rough year. And a lot of things were happening, and so we immediately put her into an outpatient rehab, and then found out her sister was also smoking pot and stuff and drinking, so we tried to put her in there, but she convinced us she was not an alcoholic, so we let her go. But the other one definitely, there was no question. And so what you did as part of the outpatient rehab again was she had to go to AA meetings, and she was 15 years old at this point, and I had to drive her. And so I drove her to the meetings, and I sat there and listened. And, and I started hearing the message. And I just, I knew immediately that this is where I needed to be, that all those years that I was out there was just so unnecessary, and that, this was the place where I could be safe and I could get healthy, and there was no hope out there for me. So I started going. Her sobriety date is October 15th, 1994, and we started going to these meetings, and I picked the young people's group for her to go to. It was in the Where and When, and I took her there, and that's where we met our home group. And I didn't think of it as my home group. I thought it was, this is where she's going. And in fact, the first meeting we went to, I picked it because I was like, I want my kids to have the best. So I picked it in this town called Chevy Chase, which outside of D.C., which is like a rich town. So I said, okay, she's going to go with the rich people in AA, And so I said, and at the young people's meeting. So that's where that's where I took her, and in the meeting, and she's there with, there's all these clean cut, really great looking kids. You know, I thought, oh, this is where I want her to be. She, of course, has green hair and has part of it pulled out, and she's got combat boots with writing all over it. I mean, she's a mess. But anyway, that's what I wanted her to look like, that, you know. But she decided during the meeting, she had to get a sponsor, she was told by the rehab. And during the meeting, she, you know, she decided the next girl that shares is going to be my sponsor, just like that. And so the next girl that shares starts crying like crazy because her boyfriend just broken up with her, and she couldn't talk without bursting into tears. And that's who she got to be her sponsor, and it happened to be Bridget, who that was here speaking for you a few years ago, or a few months ago, rather. And Bridget's got like 14 or 15 years now, and she's done great. You know, that was just a weak moment, and it ended up being a great relationship. That, I mean, I'm very, very grateful for that that moment. But, you know, I actually met my current sponsor there that night, but, you know, I didn't think much about it. You know, I was just driving. You know, I was driving her. But over the next few months, things happened that, you know, that I just knew more and more I had to be there. And I had to be an Alcoholics Anonymous. And I, you know, I thought I would get a woman sponsor, and I thought I would, you know, go to old people meetings, you know. And I didn't think I'd be in a young people's group for this long. But, you know, what happened was that, you know, my sponsor, my husband had come home for a while and was trying to work it out, and that was very short-lived. He ended up that year living with me, but not living with me, and dating another woman, and finally he left. My mother got very sick, and she ended up dying at the end of that year. And but just before that happened, I was in a meeting at Christmas time, and my current sponsor was leading that meeting. It was a discussion meeting, and I shared, you know, and I'd been going to these meetings for a couple months then, and I said, just spilled out everything that had been going on and what had happened. And And, you know, he turned and looked at me and said, you know, you don't have to do this alone. And it just touched my heart because I felt so alone. I felt so like I had to do everything, you know. And one of the things I shared that night was that, you know, we had a Christmas tree my ex-husband had dropped off at our house. And my kids and I were just so down that we couldn't even get the energy to get the Christmas decorations out and to decorate the tree. We just couldn't do it. And, after the meeting, Bridget came up to me and said, you know, I'll come over and help you decorate the tree. And I know now that, you know, I'm sure my sponsors had suggested it, but, you know, she was willing to do it. She was there, and she came over, and we were able to get the stuff. I mean, it gave me the energy that I didn't have to find the stuff and, you know, to decorate the tree and clean up the house a little bit and, you know, just stuff like that. Just, you know, 4 days after Christmas, my mom died, and I knew I was in trouble then. I knew that I really needed to do something different. And so when I came back from New Jersey from the funeral, I asked my sponsor to sponsor me. I hadn't met any women sponsors. I mean, I was just going to these meetings with the young people, and at that time, I thought I had 13 years of sobriety because I hadn't drank. And he had more time than I did, and he's 2.5 years older than I am. Those were my criteria. So, and I said, okay. So I asked him, and he's been my sponsor ever since, and it's been a really great, great relationship. It's worked really well for me, and it's exactly what I needed, because even though my life was falling apart, I knew what was going on. I thought I knew what was going on, you know, and I had accomplished some stuff in my life in spite of me, and you know, so it gave me a bigger head than I really deserved. And my sponsor speaks very loud and really gets to me when other people couldn't do that. And I know that today for sure that, you know, he saved my life by, you know, being there. Because if I had gone to the meetings I'd gone to before, I wouldn't be here today. I can guarantee that. I would have talked my way out of Alcoholics Anonymous again because I would have known better, you know. And what's happened is that, you know, my life has changed completely. I immediately got put on the steps. And he, you know, he said, well, you know, I guess you have two sobriety dates then, because I didn't want to give up my 13 years. And he said, okay, you've got a drug sobriety date and you have an alcohol sobriety date. And I said, okay. And then, you know, I went through the next few months listening to meetings and listening to what other people shared. Nobody else had two sobriety dates, you know. And then I went to a conference that we actually gave in Arlington, and they wanted to know what your sobriety date was for the countdown. And by this time, I was just nuts about what my sobriety date was. And I had an appointment the Monday after this conference to do my fifth step. And, you know, by the end of the weekend, and, you know, I went to do my fifth step. I said, okay, I give up. I'm changing my sobriety date. Because I knew that this was not right. And so that's April 17th, 1995. That's the day I chose because we agreed that I was definitely, you know, I'd gotten off the pills right away. But, you know, we just agreed that was a good day for me to choose, that I was definitely clean and sober from that day on. And that's been the case, that I've been clean and sober completely from that day on. And so that's my sobriety date. And I'm grateful for that. And the things that were so different this time around in my sobriety are just amazing. You know, I definitely have been doing the steps, which I hadn't done. My big book was virginal when I got here the second time. And, you know, I've been through that, and I read that every day, and I get reminded to read it every day. And, you know, there's, strong sponsorship. I'm in a group with strong sponsorship, and I'm grateful for it because I need that structure because I can talk my way out of anything. If someone's being really, you know, soft and sweet with me, it's not going to work. And so I've learned to, my thinking has changed, my feelings have changed because my actions have changed. I've taken actions that I wouldn't have chosen to take, you know. Like when I was new, there was all this stuff I had to do. I have a pigeon today that's going through this where she's got all this stuff she's got to do, and God forbid that she should actually hang out with other people in Alcoholics Anonymous instead of maybe doing some of this stuff. And so I got to do these things that I thought, well, I should be home doing this, but no. I went out and hung out with people, and it really made a difference in my life, that I felt like I was part of something that was bigger than myself and that there was a lot more hope in my life and I wasn't isolating and being alone and in my head, which is a very dangerous place for me and for many of us. I know that, you know. I've heard it called the wild kingdom, heard it called the temple of the absurd, and a bad neighborhood, don't go in it. You know, it's like that. And it's true for me totally today, even if I leave myself alone too long. And so I, you know, what I started doing was going to events and going to other, you know, going with people to meetings that they were speaking at. You know, I never heard about AA conferences in the first 6 years I was sober. Never heard any of that. And there's a big one in Ocean City every year called Sessions that people from D.C. go to all the time. I didn't even know it existed. And so I started doing those things and really getting excited about Alcoholics Anonymous. And it was just amazing. And then when I got 6 months of sobriety, they handed me a pigeon, which was like, what are you doing? I don't know what I'm doing. I can't feel, you know. And I was very resistant to it, like, and was told that I was being self-centered. So I went ahead and I tried to work with her. And it was just a good experience. She really couldn't get it, but... you know, it was the beginning of something very special that I had always wanted to be the helper. You know, when that woman called me to help her with she's having the miscarriage, you know, I felt so good inside about her calling me and asking for help because I never knew how to help people. I mean, I was being helped all the time, but I didn't know how to help other people. And so, you know, that's, you know, probably why I was drinking. I was celebrating that someone wanted me to help, and I screwed it up. But, you know, now I had a chance to be of help and service to other people, and I learned how to do it by watching my sponsor, watching other people in my group with time, like watching Bridget, watching another girl that's sober about the same time, Beth. They helped me so much when I was new. And they're half my age, but it didn't matter. They had a lot more time in sobriety than I did, you know, in true sobriety. And so I got to find out what it was like to sponsor other people, and I get to do that today. And in that, I think, is a total gift because I am so self-centered and as a natural thing. And I need that kind of help to get out of myself and to think about other people. Like, we're driving here today, and I kept getting all these phone calls from people, and it really is, you know, it's like my ringer was driving us nuts. But, you know, in a way, it just made me feels good to be able to be there for other people. And, you know, even though I worry about some of them, and some of them are real pain in the butt sometimes, you know, it's like, you know, if I can get through a little bit, it makes a huge difference for me, and it makes a little some difference for them. It's a real gift. And some of the other stuff I've gotten into recently in Alcoholics Anonymous has really been a gift. I started to get involved in H&I this year ago, and a little over a year ago, I guess. And now I help organize. We've been reaching out and trying to get institutions to open up meetings for H&I, and so I've been trying to get people to fit into those meetings. And it just feels good that, and we've gotten actually a lot of new people from some of those meetings, because there were people dying to get help there, and they weren't finding places to go. They'd finish their rehabs and then they'd be lost. And now that we're really trying to reach out and really build H&I in Montgomery County and D.C. and Prince George's County, which is our intergroup area, it's really made a big difference in the area. We've grown, like, doubled our meetings, doubled our H&I meetings at least, and that's been a wonderful part of it. And I take a couple of meetings myself, and I've, gotten to talk to some of the people and actually sponsored someone for a while from one of the meetings. So that's been a real gift, too. And then the friendships that I've developed, the love that I feel in our group, and the love that, that I get to learn how to give, which, was not natural for me either. And it's just amazing. It's just amazing. I mean, my friends here are just amazing. It's like I didn't have friends like that before. I had one friend. So she's still a friend, but I had one friend, basically, that I hung out with before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous this time. And now there's a host of friends. And it's really amazing that I can have that gift, too. Still got time, don't we? Oh, okay. All right. I have to say that that everything hasn't been completely wonderful. I started my eighth-step list in January of 1996, and I completed it in February of 2006. And I don't recommend that to anybody. And I'll tell you what happened is, like, I wrote the list real quick. That was easy. And then I had to write what I did. And I, that took some time because I'm a procrastinator that's one of my big defects. And what I did was I wrote down what I did, but I never, ever could look at how I affected the other person. And so I gave this list to my sponsor a couple of times, and he wouldn't tell me what was wrong with it. He wanted me to see it, And he'd just say, that is the most self-centered thing I've ever seen in my life. And they'd give it back to me, and I'd have to start working on it again. And so finally I heard in the meeting. I listened in a meeting one day, and this woman spoke about how she affected the people and how it was on her list. And I said, oh, my God, that's what's missing. So that I did this or this or this isn't what's so important as to what kind of reaction they could have had to what I did, Looking at that. And when I wrote that this time, it's like I was bawling the whole time. I was like crying the whole time. And that's what I was so afraid of, was looking at how I could be impacting someone else in such a negative way. So I was able to, and the way I was able to do it, and we do this all the time as we help each other, I went to a friend's house. I went to Bridget's house, and I sat in her basement at her computer, and every time I had a question or I felt uncomfortable, I went up and talked to her about it, because she helped me through some of this. The ultimate person that's going to help me with my amends is my sponsor, Mike, but, she's, one of my sister pigeons, and she really did help me through this. And, getting that kind of help is incredible. That's what we do for each other here. It's we support each other, and we build each other up that way. Tomorrow, one of my pigeons is going to a hearing for court. She had her second DWI. She came to one of our meetings drunk, and when she left, she got caught, and she was already on probation for a DWI, so she may very well end up in jail tomorrow, but, we're going to be there for her. We're going to show up, She's got 3 weeks of sobriety now, and so it's hard to say that she's saved, but we can definitely be there for her and give her support, and that's what we're doing. She got kidnapped to the beach this weekend, so she got to have a really good time with people. And, she's still a little hesitant about what Alcoholics Anonymous is for her. But, you know, I think she's seeing some real positive things, and hopefully, you know, she'll maybe get, you know, weekend jail time or something where she can keep her job. That's what I'm more concerned about. But I just have a feeling that she's going to really try to stay sober this time and stay with us, because she's seeing what the love that you can get here and the help you can get. So that's pretty amazing. I don't know. I forgot to tell you that both my kids are sober, and I'm grateful for that. Shortly after, in fact, I changed my sobriety date on April 17th, and on April 20th, Kathleen showed up at her first AA meeting. She had decided that, you know, I don't know, sometimes I think it was like, you know, she was being left alone when we were going to meetings, but she decided that, you know, she was done. You know, she hadn't been doing what she did for a very long time, but she did it with total gusto, and just like everybody else in my family, and she really decided that this is what she wanted. She wanted to be sober, and so she has 11 years also. Her sobriety date is April 20th, 1995. And Julie just loves the fact now, after I changed my date, that she's got more time than I do. And she lives in Boston, and she's, you know, she dropped out of school. She almost drank in her first freshman year of college because, you know, even though she had her own room, there was drinking all over the place. And so she came back home, and she finally went to junior college for a couple years, and then she transferred to a school in Boston, and she's now working up there, and she loves it, and I'm so proud of her. She's doing a great job, and, you know, it's Alcoholics Anonymous, though, that really did it. I mean, she ended up getting straight A's in her junior college and was, you know, all-star tennis player and, you know, just a lot of stuff like that. She couldn't do that when she was drinking. She was dropping out of stuff. She got kicked out of high school, you know. She did get back in that school after being sober a year and going to we have these alternative high schools there. She went to an alternative high school sophomore year, and with Bridget's help, she wrote a request to be accepted back into her. It was a private school, so she had to get accepted back into the school, and they took her back. She, you know, showed that she was a different, you know, changed a lot since she had been kicked out, and they took the chance and took her back, and she did well, and I'm really just so happy about that. But it was Alcoholics Anonymous, totally. Always. And then Kathleen has graduated from college, and she's got a really great job, works for Homeland Security as a investigator, and, you know, she's just really happy about what they're doing with their lives, and they're happy about being sober and living these lives. And when they were in high school, I didn't have to worry about them getting into drunk driving accidents, you know, unless someone else hit them, but they were going to prom with, you know, just for sober kids. We have had a lot of sober high school kids in our group, and a lot of them have grown up now. They're like in their 20s and 30s now, but, you know, they started out as 16, 17-year-olds, you know, sober. And it's a great group. We have like 350 people in it now. And we range from, you know, we have a 14-year-old actually in there now, and all the way up through a lot of 20s and 30s, and there's a few of us, you know, over 40, over 50, almost another age, you know. And but you know, it's and we're accepted. Everybody's accepted because it's a family. It's really a family, and we have a great time, and we stay sober together, and it's a gift. So thank you.